English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iranians hold nationwide rallies to condemn a French magazine's insults to the country's religious and national values. A Black Lives Matter co-founder says one of his relatives has been killed after being repeatedly teased by the Los Angeles police. And Ukraine says it has become a de facto member of the NATO military alliance, given the continued supply of weapons by the West. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iranians have rallied in several cities to protest insulting cartoons published by a French magazine, Charlie Hebdo. The Iranian protesters condemned the French magazine for insulting their religious and national sanctities and values. They also slammed the French government for its double standard approach towards freedom of speech. Iranian officials have also reacted to the publication of cartoons. President Ibrahim Raisi condemned the sacrilege. He said, "Resorting to insults under the pretext of freedom indicates the West's despair and failure in their recent riots that they fanned in Iran." Separately, Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani advised the French authorities to follow the basic principles of international law, and that is mutual respect and honoring religious values of other countries. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran will continue to offer solid support to the resistance movements in Lebanon and Palestine in the face of threats and aggressions by the Israeli regime. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a joint press conference with his Lebanese counterpart following their meeting in Lebanon's capital. The minister said they discussed ways to expand trade, economic and tourism cooperation, as well as regional developments. He said Iran is now ready to build power plants in Lebanon. Amir Abdullahian said Iran has been and will be a friend of Lebanon in tough times. Elsewhere in his remarks, he urged the Lebanese political parties to quickly engage in dialogue over picking a president for Lebanon. He said Iran has not interfered in Lebanon's internal affairs, and it is certain that the Lebanese parties can agree on a single candidate without interference by any other country. Iran's top diplomat is scheduled to meet Lebanon's prime minister, the parliament speaker, during his visit. To Palestine now, the health ministry says another youth has succumbed to injuries sustained during an Israeli raid near the West Bank city of Jenin. 18-year-old Abdul Hadi Fakhri Nazal has been hit in the chest and the neck by Israeli forces live fire in the town of Qabtia. He was taken to hospital in critical condition. Nazal was the second casualty of Israeli forces' assault on Qabtia to arrest Palestinian fighters. Earlier, the 25-year-old Habib Muhammad Ismail died of wounds sustained from Israeli forces' gunfire. The new fatalities came after Israeli troops killed 41-year-old Samir Aslan during an overnight raid in Kalandia refugee camp in occupied Al-Quds. Israeli soldiers have killed 9 Palestinians since the start of the year, including 3 minors.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Kalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Kalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanad Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil on Wednesday. 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Now to the United States, where police brutality takes another victim. A black man, Kenan Anderson, died hours after he was repeatedly tasered and restrained by Los Angeles police following a traffic accident. Anderson, 31 years old, was a teacher and a father. He was also the cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder. Anderson went into cardiac arrest several hours after this encounter on January the 3rd. Los Angeles police released body camera footage of the incident after a sparked outcry. They say Anderson tried to run away after a car crash. The cause of his death has not been officially determined. The Black Lives Matter says Anderson was killed by the police. His death brings to 3 the number of people killed in encounters with Los Angeles police in less than a week. Police brutality against black people is a source of public outcry in the U.S. Also happening in the U.S., a tornado and powerful storms have ravaged the southeastern state of Alabama, leaving 6 people dead. Local officials say the victims were killed in Ogata County. Other parts of Alabama have been hit as well, with at least 6 of them declaring a state of emergency. Storms have continued to hit neighboring state of Georgia as well. High winds and heavy rains have damaged homes, leaving thousands of people without power in both states. The National Weather Service says at least 2 storm systems are also set to hit California and the Pacific Northwest starting on Friday and over the weekend. 19 people have already been killed in the week in California and floods triggered by heavy rains. To Latin America now. In Peru, people turned out in the capital to protest the government's response to the ongoing unrest sparked by the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo.
It's not fair. I know of people taking to the streets to protest and they are outraged like me. We're being accused of being terrorists, but we aren't terrorists.
Protesters held placards reading "Down with a dictatorship." They chanted slogans against incumbent President Dina Boluarte, calling on her to resign. At least 42 people have been killed since the unrest broke out in Peru in December. Over half of them were killed in the past few days. Labor Minister Eduardo Garcia has stepped down in reaction to the government's handling of the unrest. He has also called for early elections. That is also the same demand of protesters. They want the closure of Congress and the release of Castillo as well. He is in detention for attempting to dissolve Congress and to avoid an impeachment. To Brazil now, President Lula da Silva says those who took part in the Sunday attacks on the government buildings in the capital likely had inside help. Lula da Silva pointed the finger at, quote, conniving agents from the police and armed forces.
I am convinced that the door of the Plan Alto Palace was open so that these people could enter because there was no broken door at the entrance. That is, it means that someone facilitated their entry here. We're going to investigate and see what happened.
The president said he had ordered a thorough review of the presidential palace staff. The mop-up operation comes after backers of former far-right President Jair Bolsonaro stormed the presidential palace, Congress, and the Supreme Court. The storming of government buildings was aimed at overthrowing Lula's government a week after he took office. They looted government offices, destroyed priceless works of art, and left graffiti messages calling for a military coup. Nearly 2,000 rioters have been arrested and more than 1,100 put under continued detention. A poll published on Wednesday said 93% of Brazilians condemned Sunday's violent riots. Welcome to this edition of the News Review. In this edition, fighting intensifies between Russian and Ukrainian forces for control of the town of Soledar in eastern Donetsk region. Ukraine says it is resisting, quote, high-intensity Russian offensive. It also says that the Russian military has relocated main forces to the Donetsk front. Ukraine says it is a difficult phase of the war, but its forces are holding out in Soledar. The forces on Wednesday said that they were in control of the key town. Russia, however, urged caution and reported advances. Ukrainian officials say more than 500 civilians remain trapped in Soledar as fighting goes on. Another development, Russia has said that Belarus may enter the Ukraine conflict if Kiev invades their country. Also, Russia is saying that it has completed the liberation of the city of Soledar in eastern Ukraine. Now, this is some breaking news that we just received from the war. Ukraine's defense minister, in the meantime, says that his country has become, in his words, a de facto member of the NATO military alliance. He says that is because Ukraine is receiving Western weaponry and knows how to use them. He also said that the West will certainly provide Ukraine with the weapons it has long been seeking. He added that the country will also become a member of NATO by law in the near future. The Ukrainian defense minister made the comments in an interview with the BBC. Ukraine officially submitted its bid to join NATO soon after Russia launched its war in February 2022. Russia is strongly opposed to the membership. Moscow sees NATO's eastward expansion as a threat to its security. Earlier this week, the Russian security official said that his country is in fact fighting NATO and the West and not Ukraine as they continue to give arms to Kiev. Now, to continue that discussion, we're joined by our correspondent, Johnny Miller, who is located in Crimea. And also we have with us John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us live from Belgrade. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with our correspondent, Johnny. We just received some breaking news that Russia announced that it has liberated the Soledar region. If you could please give us more updates on the situation there.
Yes, well, that does seem to be the case. The private military organization Wagner, fighting for the Russian in Russian forces, captured Soledar. We've seen images of their soldiers on the streets. This is a strategically important settlement. It opens the way to take Bakhmut. The Russians have been trying for months to take Bakhmut, but now we're seeing some of those fierce fighting of the war so far, as the Russians try to succeed. There are dozens, probably hundreds of soldiers being killed or wounded every day right now. There's also been talks for weeks of the potential of another front opening up, another major offensive being launched by the Russians, a big build.
Well, it seems that we have some technical difficulties. We've lost connection with Johnny Miller. So let's continue this with Mr. John Bosnich. We heard the Ukrainian official practically stating that NATO has accepted Ukraine as a de facto member. The sign and testimony to that is the weapons that are being used in Ukraine, with Ukrainian soldiers actually being able to use them, being trained to use those weapons. What does this signify, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, the entire presentation by the Ukrainian defense minister is actually nothing more than propaganda. Point number one, NATO membership can only be decided by a unanimous vote of all current members of NATO. That means all of the countries in Europe which are members of NATO, and Canada and the United States. We already know that Hungary has said that it has no interest in widening this war and expanding the war. We're expecting easily a veto, in other words, non-agreement to Ukrainian membership from Hungary. There are other possible countries which would say the same thing. I do not think that there is any possibility, in other words, zero possibility of a unanimous NATO vote to accept Ukraine. Number two, when a country is accepted as a member of NATO, its primary requirement is that it has sovereignty over its own territory. At the current time, Russia has claimed and annexed four provinces, which were formerly part of Ukraine, but Ukraine does not recognize those territories as a part of Russia, which means that Ukraine itself states that it does not have sovereign control over its own territory, which means it's not eligible for membership in NATO. If we take that a step further, if NATO were to violate its own charter, if it were to force the membership of Ukraine against the wishes of Hungary and probably result in Hungary leaving NATO, and if Ukraine then became a NATO state, that would mean that NATO would automatically be in a state of war. That means Canada would be at war, America would be at war, England would be at war, France would be at war, Italy would be at war, in a declared war, because the territory of the country that they recognize as Ukraine is currently occupied and held by Russian troops and actually populated by Russian citizens. So the entire prospect is ridiculous, and it makes no sense except as a piece of propaganda. So I would suggest that the Minister of Defense of Ukraine change his title from Minister of Defense to Minister of Propaganda.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Johnny Miller, live from Crimea, and Mr. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. And now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Terrorist attack in Shahjarah Shrine disgraced the hypocritical, black-hearted Americans. This is the part of Imam Khamenei's speech in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on Tuesday, December 20, 2022, which was delivered when he met with a number of the families of the martyrs who were murdered in the Shahjarah terrorist attack. The tragic yet glorious tragedy that took place in the holy shrine of Ahmad ibn Musa Shah Charagh, peace be upon him, is one that will remain permanently in history. This tragedy must not be forgotten. Of course, it will not be forgotten. But even so, our cultural institutions, our media networks, and our artistic organizations need to preserve, give attention to, and show this event in the same way that they give attention to Ashura tragedy and other historical events. They need to pass news of this on to the future generations. We have had shortcomings in these areas. We have shortcomings when it comes to the media, to the spreading of information, and to exposing events. Many of our youths are unaware of the events that took place 20 years ago. They do not know about the crimes committed by MEK terrorists.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
During the month of Ramadan in 1981, in this same city of Shiraz, a number of MEK terrorists broke into the Honorable Dr. Muhammad Hassan Tahiri's house at the time for breaking the fast and showered him and his family with bullets. During the month of Ramadan in Shiraz, I visited their home a while later. Unfortunately, our younger generation is unaware of many of these events. We have not worked hard enough to raise awareness in these areas. Those who work in the field of the arts should work on this. Now, you younger people who are here today, those of you who are talented in the field of the arts, the media, writing, and raising awareness in the people, I want you to remember that these things are some of our obligatory duties. Anyway, I would like to once again extend my condolences to all of you, the families of these noble martyrs. I would like to offer both my condolences and my congratulations to you. You should be congratulated. These martyrs have attained high status, both the children and the adults. There were children among them, adults, the young, women, men, city people, and villagers. They are all attained high positions. That is truly something to be congratulated about. And of course, please accept my condolences too. God willing, may God grant you patience and reward you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
People. The United States has portrayed itself as a vanguard of the civilized world, locked in a so-called war on terror. The justification for the trail of destruction and murder that Washington left behind in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere is that the U.S. is fighting evil and terror. Many have, of course, pointed out the hypocrisy of that very notion. But Washington's growing relations with the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, a terror group that has killed thousands of people, is indeed the height of that hypocrisy.
Dancing to Tune of Terrorists.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya. Now, the United States foreign policy has been hypocritical in so many ways. Washington's dealing with terror is perhaps the most striking case. For Washington, terrorists are divided into the good and bad. Now, many people who hear this would go, this is going too far. But if you look at Washington's relations with the MKO terror group, you can hardly dispute that. The group has killed thousands of Iranians in gross terrorist attacks. So gross, even Washington had the name of the MKO on its terrorist list up until the year 2012. Now, although the terror group has not changed one bit, U.S. is now considering it as an ally. So does such hypocrisy matter in U.S. foreign affairs? And to discuss just that, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joining us from Hamilton, Ontario, and Olsi Jasheshi, historian and journalist who is joining us from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Stay tuned.
The United States and its Western allies have incited violent riots in Iran with every possible means. This included backing groups that could do the bidding inside the country, like the notorious Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization. The U.S. has recently hosted a gathering of anti-Iran groups in Washington to support rioters in Iran. Former senior American officials like Secretary of State Mike Pompeo attended the meeting. He has reportedly gone as far as to recognize the MKO leader Maryam Rajavi as the interim president of Iran and the so-called revolution that is happening there.
Now, the extent to which the American establishment has bought into the narratives projected by the MKO terrorist group is just unbelievable. To make such statements is either a sign of miscalculated policy or simply desperation. But why should the U.S. support a cult and terrorist group like the MKO, really?
The answer is simple. Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran changed the mega projects of United States in the Middle East for the extermination of Palestine and the Palestinians. The support that Iran gave and gives to the issue of Palestine have turned Iran into enemy number one of the United States. And United States, in order to make sure that Israel and its apartheid regime will survive in the Middle East, will do anything on its power to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Now, the U.S. has used everything in its power to confront the Islamic Republic of Iran. Sanctions, a maximum pressure campaign, and of course, terrorism. So what role does the latter play in the larger Washington's policy towards Iran?
From the end of the Second World War until about 1979, the U.S. dominated the Middle East. However, in 1979, the Iranian Revolution took place and pulled out one of the main pillars of the U.S. domination. The other two pillars, namely Saudi Arabia and Israel, remained in place. Since 1979, the U.S. has been trying with various means to destabilize and overturn the Islamic Republic. They have used proxy wars, such as with Iraq. They have used economic sanctions. They have used maximum pressure campaigns, and they have used terrorism. And among the most prominent terrorist organizations that they have used, aside from the State of Israel, of course, is the MKO. The MKO is the organization that the U.S. has nurtured for decades, first in Iraq, and then stationed with thousands of warriors in the U.S. proxy state of Albania. So the MKO is the principal terrorist organization on which the U.S. relies for the destabilization and the of eventual overthrow, in their opinion, of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A couple of years ago, John Bolton, in a meeting with MKO officials, projected that the Islamic Republic's days are numbered.
For over 10 years since coming to these events, that the declared policy of the United States of America should be the overthrow of the mullah's regime in Tehran. The behavior and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself. And that's why before 2019, we here will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much.
In remarks that strike a familiar tone, some U.S. officials in the recent meeting in Washington have projected the same thing. It seems Washington is taking no page from its past mistakes.
This represents, actually, is wishful thinking on the part of U.S. politicians such as John Bolton. Actually, despite 44 years of attempts at the destabilization of Iran and the suffering that the Iranian people have had to endure as a result of sanctions and hybrid warfare, the fact is that the government of the Islamic Republic enjoys and still continues to enjoy the widespread support of the majority of people in Iran.
Now, the U.S. and its allies have been voicing outright support for the rioters who have been trying to hijack recent protests in Iran. Large numbers of Iranian civilians and security forces have died in the riots so far, as the Western allies increasingly glorify the violence. Now, Iranian intelligence apparatus has recently arrested MKO agents in connection with the violence.
Our viewers throughout the world have to understand the bigger picture. And the bigger picture and the reason why Iran is being attacked with fake news, with riots. Many of the rioters we know very well, they were being paid. They were receiving a huge amount of money from U.S. and European government to go and attack public institutions in Iran. And the Mujahideen as well, they are part of this greater web and this continuing war which is waged against Iran since 1979. The Americans and Israelis will never stop sponsoring any kind of terrorist group, including the notorious cult of Mariam Rajavi, that can harm Iran.
Many would say it is Trump's team, or generally Republicans, that are publicly supporting the MKO so much. Is there a difference between Democrats and Republicans in their policy towards the terror group?
There is no fundamental difference between Republicans and Democrats on the question of Iran. When they are in power or out of power, the goal remains the same, namely the regime change in Tehran. Now, in practice, it's more difficult for a sitting president such as Biden to deal with a known terrorist organization as the MKO while he is in office in Washington. It's much easier for Mr. Trump, who is now out of power and out of favor in Washington, to make louder noises in support of the MKO. But fundamentally, when they are in power, it makes no difference between Republicans and Democrats as to the outlook of the United States towards Iran. And that outlook remains regime change.
The U.S. instrumental use of terrorists to advance its agenda is not confined to the MKO. Donald Trump claimed that former President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton founded ISIS, or the Daesh terrorist group.
Look, if we see U.S. government policies towards the Mujahideens, they still do consider the Mujahideen as terrorists. Maryam Rajavi, she is not allowed to enter in the United States and the United Kingdom. So for the British and the Americans, Maryam Rajavi, the Mujahideens, they are terrorists. But for as long as these terrorists serve to the imperialist agenda of the United States, they are on the side of Americans. We know very well the story of the emails of Hillary Clinton, when one of her officials was telling to Clinton that ISIS is on our side in Syria. So exactly like the Americans used ISIS against the government of Bashar al-Assad, the same thing they are doing against Iran.
Now, the MKO has a very dark history of assassinations and bombings against the Iranian government and people. It notoriously sided with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during Iraq's 1980 to 1988 war against the Islamic Republic. But after fall of the Iraqi dictator, the group had to leave Iraq and now resides in Albania. Now, if the United States cherishes the MKO so much, why isn't the group allowed to enter America?
The Americans didn't, when they evacuated the Mujahideens from Iraq, they didn't send them to the United Kingdom, they didn't send them to the European Union, they didn't send them even in the United States. They found a lawless country, like Albania is, which is run by a very corrupt government, which, I mean, all people who know about what is happening in Albania, they know that most of the ministers of the present government of Edi Rama, they are corrupt, and some of his ministers, they are even in jail for trafficking drugs or stealing state properties. So the Americans found a lawless country like Albania is, where even the local laws do not work, and they send them there. In a way, the Americans, when they evacuated MEK from Iraq, they needed to find a Guantanamo. But Guantanamo, where they built their infamous prison in Cuba, is too far. So they created a European Guantanamo in Albania. The Americans know very well what MEK does in its camp.
Now, the MKO used to be regarded as a terrorist organization, even by Washington itself, but is now helping the U.S. devise its policies against Iran. Seems like the U.S. has a classification for good and bad terrorists.
The U.S. Does have a two-tiered classification of armed struggles going on around the world. They support, the U.S. supports terrorist groups and has supported terrorist groups for its own foreign policy ends. And I'm referring to, for example, ISIS in Iraq and Syria, Al-Qaeda in the former Yugoslavia, the Contras in Nicaragua, and the Azov Battalion in Ukraine. These are ones that the U.S. regards as, quote, freedom fighters, and they support. But true freedom fighters, such as the Palestinians, who are fighting against the occupation of their homeland by the apartheid state of Israel, in the eyes of the U.S. government, these are regarded as terrorists.
Now, of course, the U.S. public is not told that their politicians are working with a terrorist organization. There must have been a spin narrative or propaganda. The meeting in Washington, for example, is referred to in the media as a gathering of Iranian opposition groups.
The Western mainstream media has little or no independence of Western governments. It merely echoes the policies of their corporate masters and their governments. And so when the United States sees freedom fighters in Ukraine or freedom fighters in Syria or any other country where it has an ulterior motive to destabilize or overthrow a government, the mainstream media holds up these terrorist mercenaries as heroes. On the other hand, the mainstream media, again, echoes the positions of the U.S. government and the corporation, the corporate class in North America.
The MKO works as a kind of proxy group for the United States and its allies. European countries and their media, in particular Albania, also go to great lengths to whitewash the cult.
The Mujahideen first came to Albania. Albanian, Greek, Serbian, Italian media, and many other European medias, including British media, they reported a lot on the cruel nature of this terrorist cult. But what has happened during the past years, the Americans and the Mujahideen themselves and Israelis, they have done all they can to blackmail European medias and to keep a censorship about what the Mujahideens are doing in Albania. We know with our first-hand experience in Albania, the Mujahideens, they have blackmailed dozens of TV stations and newspapers in Albania, which were reporting the horrible situation of the Mujahideen slave soldiers within the camp of Mariam Rajavi. What the Mujahideens did against this media, in some cases, they used Albanian security services to blackmail the owners of this media. In other cases, when they couldn't use these services, they used bribes. They paid huge amount of money to many TV stations and newspapers so that they write nothing about them.
Throughout history, the United States has used militias and terrorist groups to serve its interests in one form or another. Now, these groups are special assets for a country like America, a country that is constantly at war with other nations. Foot soldiers on the ground really matter here, and armed militia and terrorists are a great option.
The U.S. maintains other terrorist groups in other countries, such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which have been shown over and over again to have been and are still U.S. assets. And the U.S. maintains a number of groups, fascist, neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine, the most notorious of which was the Azov Battalion. All of these groups served one purpose, and that is to allow the U.S. to use these people as their foot soldiers on the ground in theaters of conflict where the U.S. wanted to destabilize a government or establish a new regime or start a new war. And the U.S. can do this because it is a powerful empire, and it can print its dollars endlessly. At least it's been able to do so up to now because the U.S. dollar has been the means of savings and exchange for most of the countries of the world up to the point of the war in Ukraine. So the U.S. has done this in many areas of the world, and it continues to maintain these terrorist groups on the payroll, along with leaders of these groups and political leaders that they keep in various places in exile, just to be used in case they are necessary for some foreign policy aim.
The MKO is a much-hated group inside Iran, even among the opposition. After all, the cult-like organization sided with Saddam Hussein in his war on Iran in the 1980s. Many would say the MKO is a spent force and that Washington is just betting on the wrong horse here. Does the U.S. change its approach towards the group in the future?
Well, like the special American envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, declared a few weeks ago in one of his declarations, the Americans do not see MEK as an alternative to the government of Iran, for which the Mujahideens, even they attacked back Robert Malley. Now, what the Americans are doing with MEK is exactly what they did with ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. God forbid, if one day we will have a regime change in Iran, the first thing that the Americans will do after this is they will either kill the Mujahideens or they will jail them and they will force them to de-radicalize themselves, exactly what they did with the Syrian terrorists of Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra. So the Mujahideens, they are a ticking bomb for the Americans. They know who they are, but they use them for as long as they serve to their agenda.
It's hard to predict the future, but we can certainly say that the U.S. Maintains such groups for its foreign policy ends. Despite the fact that the MKO is very unpopular in Iran because it has been responsible for almost 20,000 deaths over the last 40 years, nonetheless, the U.S. Has many tools it keeps in its foreign policy toolbox, and terrorist organizations such as the MKO are one of them. We would hope that the U.S. government, someone in the U.S. government at some point, would realize that Iran, the Iranian Revolution, and the Islamic Republic of Iran are here to stay, and to learn to live with the Iranian Republic and the people of Iran in a friendly manner instead of treating it as an enemy and illegally meddling in its internal affairs, which it does all the time and has done so since 1953.
The United States' cooperation with the MKO is a clear-cut case of the maxim of the end justifies the means. It is very simple. Just because the terror group is against Iran, the U.S. supports it. That's it. And all the talks about the human rights and justice and so on really matter nothing here. For Washington, good terrorists like the MKO are assets that can advance its policies in West Asia. Period.
The United States has gone through great lengths to counter Iran's growing clout in the region. Many would say wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were launched as a wider policy to contain Iran. Wars that have cost over $8 trillion, that's according to former President Donald Trump. Now, of course, Uncle Sam would have no shame to ask a terror group like the MKO for help. It's cost-effective and involves less loss of lives and materials for the U.S. And that was our show, everyone. I am your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalamu rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we want to know about the signs of reappearance. And one of the signs that we had been talking about in the previous sessions was Sufyani. We reached certain conclusions that he's just one person, not many people. He's not a symbol, he's a reality. And now we want to talk about, is this sign a certain sign or an uncertain sign? And in the previous episode, you gave us a little brief about this, but I would want you to start with the session again. That is he a certain sign?
We talk about the fact that according to narrations, when it comes to signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, some of them are called mahtum or hat, meaning that they are definite, and some of them are called as indefinite. And because of the number of the narrations that have talked about this issue, that we have two categories of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam also knew about this topic. They knew that not all the signs are definite. Yeah. Some of them are indefinite. And we said in one of the previous sessions that when we are talking about indefinite signs, it means that bada may happen. Meaning that...
a change.
Yeah, there might be a change regarding these indefinite signs. But we said that when it comes to definite signs, there is no change and there is no bada. So this is showing the importance of knowing whether each sign is definite or not.
Yeah.
Regarding Sufyani, we said that there is no difference of idea among Shia scholars that he is one of the, for sure, one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. I shared one narration from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam and another from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Let me just share one more narration in this regard and then we'll go to the next topic because it's a clear issue when it comes to the definite sign for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Sufyani is for sure one of the definite signs.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam also knew, at least many of them, the closest ones, they knew about these two categories. And that is why in some narrations they asked the Imams alayhi salam whether this sign is definite or indefinite. In this narration, the famous companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Abu Hamza Thumali, says that I told Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, إِنَّ أَبَا جَعْفَرٍ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ كَانَ يَقُولُ إِنَّ خُرُوجَ السُّفْيَانِ مِنَ الْأَمْرِ الْمَحْتُومِ. Abu Ja'far, meaning Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, your father, he used to say that the movement and the uprising of Sufyani is al-amr al-mahtum, one of the definite signs.
Yeah.
قَالَ لِي نَعَمْ. And of course, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam confirmed what was mentioned by his holy father. This is in Kamal al-Din, page 652, chapter 57, hadith number 14. Mm-hmm. So the conclusion of this discussion is that...
it's a definite sign.
It is a definite sign, and based on the other narrations talking about Sufyani, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come. We'll talk about the time. So if any person claims that he is the promised Mahdi, but there is no Sufyani around, so for sure we can reject that person as a false claimant.
Yeah.
Because Sufyani is one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right. Before we move ahead, let's have a sip of water and take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm with Dr. Karimi. You're listening to The Last Savior. Dr. Karimi, we have been talking about that before the break. We made it clear that Sufyani is a certain sign which is described as Mahtum in the narrations. Mahtum means definite, a certain sign. And Bada, the concept of Bada, but that does not happen in the definite signs. And you said one of the companions of Imam Sadiq al-Islam asked him that, I heard from your father, that is Imam Baqir al-Islam, that Sufyani is a definite sign. And then Imam Sadiq al-Islam confirms it. And we came to the conclusion that, yes, Sufyani is a definite sign. Now, when we know that Sufyani is a definite sign, we know a little bit about him. Is his name Sufyani, like we discussed in the previous, we were talking about, like we said, Yamani. Is his name Yamani? Or that since he's coming from Yemen, his name is Yamani. So what is it like? Why is his name Sufyani? Or is it his real name? Or does he have some other names?
When we refer to the narrations, both in Shia and Sunni sources about this personality, we see that in most of the cases, we have two terms referring to this person. Of course, the first name or the first title is Sufyani, and the other one is Ibn Aqilat al-Akbad, the son of the liver-eating woman. This is one of the titles of Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan, and her story of, sending one person to kill Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet, and later, she tried to eat the liver of Hamza. It's mentioned in the history. So she is called Aqilatul Akbad. We may translate it as the liver-eating woman.
All right.
So Sufyani is also called Ibn Aqilat al-Akbar. So according to some narrations, his lineage goes back to Abu Sufyan. We will talk about that. So the wife of Abu Sufyan is Hind. That is why he is also called, Sufyani is also called Ibn Aqilat al-Akbar, the son of Hind, who is known as Aqilat al-Akbar.
Okay.
Of course, there are a few narrations talking about the
this
second title.
This goes back to the lineage now.
Yeah, we'll talk about the lineage later. Talking about his name, we have these two titles, Sufyani in most of the narrations, and in few narrations, Ibn Aqilat al-Akbar. But these two cannot be the names of Sufyani.
Yeah, because these are the features.
Yeah, they are the features or the epithets and the titles. Because Sufyani is, according to Arabic language, is a person attributed to Sufyan. And we say that it may refer to his lineage as one of the offsprings of Abu Sufyan or as a person who has the same features of Abu Sufyan. So As-Sufyani is the name of this personality. Okay. Ibn Aqilat al-Akbar is not his name. The title is an epithet, for example. In another narration, we have this question from the companions of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt that what is the name of Sufyani? This is in Kamaluddin, page 651, chapter 57, hadith number 11. So this narration also